The Guardian.
Hello and thanks for taking the time to listen. I'm Sean McGinty and I'm your host for the Guardian Social Enterprise Network podcast. This is podcast number 9. I'm standing in a huge and bustling space in the centre of Manchester, just a few miles from Rochdale, the birthplace of a social enterprise revolution. There's a genuine sense of pioneering spirit here too, as cooperatives from all parts of the globe have packed up their ideas and travelled to the northwest of England. From co-ops with millions of members that turn over billions, to those that turn over little but deliver trading opportunities for farmers and feed malnourished children. In this podcast, I'm exploring what leadership is in a modern social business, and there are many examples of different styles of leading here in this iconic railway station that's been a part of the skyline in this city for 130 years. It's not, of course, Manchester Central Railway Station now. It's a convention centre that this week is hosting the culmination of the UN International Year of Cooperatives. There are a lot of questions to answer about how leadership works in a company that's democratic and has voting members, how sometimes you don't need the cliché leader attributes, and how social media can create leaders of change out of thin air. Coming up.
Leadership, not to say that you don't need leaders, in a governance sense, but leadership really then is a respect for that model. It's encouraging true participation. It's respecting the people who own the business, the cooperators.
That's Charles Gould, Director General of the International Cooperative Alliance. More from him shortly. And what is leadership for a woman living in a culture dominated by men?
Women are taking the lead in South Africa to lead the cooperative, to lead the businesses, to lead the charities, and then they are the ones who are creating the job creation done by women in South Africa is very much amazing.
That's Mavis Matabata from Sedicong Salerato in South Africa. And how social businesses in themselves in this podcast can lead the way in a multinational world.
In 2007, the mutual and cooperative sector was 23.7% of the world's insurance market. 2011, we're 26.3%. That's nearly a 3% market share capture from, obviously, the stock companies.
The Guardian.
Now, a US president once said that leadership is the art of getting someone else to do something you want done because he wants to do it. But often in businesses, including those with a social purpose, we look for individuals that are leading the way. We look for larger-than-life characters that are employed to kick a corporate balance sheet into shape or to inspire change in a community through sheer force of will and gutsy determination. Now, those kind of larger-than-life people make great stories for journalists, but is that really what leadership is about? I spoke with Mavis Matabata at the South African stand in a rather noisy Manchester Central and asked her first what her social business does.
I am involved in the cooperative where we do farming. Initially, we are looking after orphans and vulnerable children as an NPO. And then we also started this cooperative where we farm on moringa. Moringa is a tree, and then we are harvesting the leaves of moringa and then agro-process them. We do the crushed leaves, the powder, and also we're doing the tea bags, the capsules, and also we are also packaging the flowers. What does moringa do? It boosts immune system. It boosts immune system. And we are using the leaves of moringa into the daily food of the children. We are feeding children with 2 meals a day. And then we started using moringa from 2006 because we find out our children were malnourished. And then after using moringa in their daily food, we saw them, the children started to blossom, and then they're living, they are now healthy. And it also addresses the problem of food insecurity, because if you have the moringa in your backyard, you have got the whole supermarket in it. If you take the nutritional composition of moringa, it has got more vitamin C than oranges, more potassium than we find in bananas, more iron than we find in spinach, more calcium than we find in fresh milk, and then more protein than we find in the protein. So
that's great for the children.
For the children, and also
you have a business producing that.
Yeah, that's what we are trading. We are packaging those leaves, and then in the form of powder, in the form of crushed leaves, and then also the flowers we're using. Also the flowers. The flowers are overloaded with antioxidants. So if a product is loaded with antioxidants, we know very well that it boosts immune system. And also we're doing we're packaging the capsules from those leaves, and then we also doing the tea bags, and then from those leaves, and we do that organic. It's organic plantation, no pesticides, no fertilizer, artificial fertilizers.
Did you lead the way in this? Did you start this? Were you the leader that kind of made this happen?
I am the leader of this cooperative. I'm leading this cooperative, and I've started the orphanage in the community down there in Limpopo.
What's your thoughts on leadership? How do you approach your cooperative in your country, and how do you lead that? What are the challenges as well?
Okay, the leading is just we must lead as a group. I cannot say I am doing it by myself, because we do have people who are farming, doing the farming there, and then we are operating that cooperative as a collective. It's not a one man show. We are doing it as a collective. And then we do have the challenges because of the children that we are feeding. We are sometimes out of funds. And then the business is not just at its infant. We don't have enough cash flow. So that's why from time to time we are trapped in that corner where we are just operating on a red tape.
Yeah. Mm. What about the culture in South Africa? It's not a place I've ever been. The culture. So in terms of you as a woman in South Africa setting this up, does that give you challenges?
We do have a challenge of the, because we are living in the male-dominated area, a scenario where men were leading everything. Then when a woman comes up, like I'm doing this moringa, I'm the first one to do moringa in South Africa. But if you can see how men are coming up with this moringa, they want to drop me, they want to cut me, they just want to compete with me. But I am taking them head on. I am on retreat. I'm forging forward. And then I'm showing the women out there that even if you are a woman, you can even take the role. You can take the lead and lead and lead professionally.
It looks certainly from this stand and from my understanding of South Africa that women are really taking the lead, aren't they, in South Africa to change things?
The women in South Africa, I can tell you that they are leading, because in most cases, in the crafts, in the agricultural sectors, you'll find women. Because of what? The women are always there looking after children, and they see abject poverty they are exposed to abject poverty on daily basis. That's why women are taking the lead in South Africa to lead the cooperative, to lead the businesses, to lead the charities, and then they are the one who are creating the job creation done by women in South Africa is very much amazing. And then I am appealing to the government to look to women in a different way, because if you go to South Africa and look at the work that women are doing, they need support, and also the backup from the government.
Can you make the men follow you?
The men can follow. They will follow us because we are taking the lead now. We are changing that mentality that the only men can do this. But women, we are now taking the control. We are now initiating things. We're coming up with innovative ideas. Women are coming up with innovative ideas, like my counterparts. If you look at my right hand side, the women are making use of paper to do crafts. Women are doing beads. So many things have been done by women.
That's Mavis Mathabatha from Sedikong Sa Lerato in South Africa, talking passionately to me about how leadership works from a woman's perspective in a culture dominated by men, and creating jobs and feeding children while she's at it. Apologies for some of the station announcements during that interview. This is the Guardian Social Enterprise podcast, and I'm Sean McGinty. So now to the nature of leadership in a social business, where the members call the shots. I brought together two people who lead organisations and sectors within the cooperative movement.
Okay, I'm Charles Gould. I'm the Director General of the International Cooperative Alliance in Geneva, Switzerland.
The interesting part about cooperatives and leadership is that it's such a participatory model that leadership actually is really replaced more by engagement for cooperatives, I think. We've just released a blueprint for a cooperative decade because we want to take this International Year of Cooperatives 2012, which will be ending shortly, and we want to use that as the base with a horizon toward 2020 in a cooperative decade. We think we have a really strong start. And what we found is that the first part of that blueprint is all about participation, because this is the most participatory model of enterprise. And if people engage, we think that's where the best decisions come in, that's where the values are kept true and authentic. And so leadership, not to say that you don't need leaders in a governance sense, but leadership really then is a respect for that model. It's encouraging true participation. It's respecting the people who own the business, the cooperators.
So can you get things done?
Yes, you can get things done.
Because sometimes leaders are thought of these people that, you know, they're at the front, they're on the charge. Whereas really, you've got to be very aware as to what your members want.
You can make decisions very quickly and get a unilateral monolithic plan in a short period of time and go absolutely nowhere. Or you can take more time and get great engagement and participation and set a vision and unleash the energy and get it done. And the second is the model that is the cooperative model.
I'm David Rogers. I am the elected president of the International Cooperative Alliance Housing Sector Organization that represents housing cooperatives around the world. In the developing world particularly, but also in the developed nations, particularly after the global financial crisis, you know, how you build and finance adequate housing to meet the needs of the population, you know, is, yes, it is. It's a basic need. And cooperatives have a real positive alternative to offer, and that positive alternative is long-term stewardship of the housing by the people who live in the members of the cooperative, and for investors, a long-term solid cash flow and a yield that will, you know, give them a good return on their investment, a good financial return, but also a social return. You know, this is actually a better way of arranging the provision and management of housing, to engage people, as Charles said, that real process of engagement. Can I go to the leadership, though? Because I agree with Charles. It is a different model. Leaders aren't there to make decisions on their own behalf in the cooperative sector. They're custodians of the democratic rights of their members. And we are accountable. So we're not like a magnet that holds power to ourselves for the sake of it. And that's what you often find in other types of business. A whole power for the benefit of the investors, for the benefit of the directors and the managers. They capture all the value. We don't do that. We actually are custodians of democratic power on behalf of our members. And therefore, we are accountable to them. Right? And leadership is about driving the vision, your members' vision, getting them to articulate that vision. And actually then, driving that vision forward on their as their custodians on their behalf, and
just
that means
across, yes. what if what your members want isn't, in your view, the most sensible thing to do?
Well, if that is true, and if that is correct, and your view is correct, then you have a responsibility to bring your members with you, to explain, to educate, to inform, to communicate with them, so that they understand that decision that you are trying to persuade, that direction that you are trying to persuade and lead them through, is the right direction. Now, like every elected officer, if you can't, then your choice is, are you the right person to be the democratic leader of that cooperative business enterprise? And even housing cooperatives are business enterprises. So that's your responsibility. And there are three key watchwords, I think, in leadership and governance in the cooperative sector, and those watchwords are openness, transparency, and accountability. They are the foundation of good governance within a democratic enterprise.
What about vision?
Oh, vision, yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. The role of a leader is to actually inspire members to develop the vision, not to develop it for them, but to develop it with them and through that engagement that Charles has spoken about. So, yes, you've got to have vision. You've got to have strategic vision. You've got to have management capacity. Just like any business, it's got to be effective. But you drive it with your members and on their behalf for the benefit of them. And I say about cooperatives, I have a simple word about co-ops. I say cooperatives are great because we're good for the people and we're good for the planet. And that is why we're so successful globally.
You worked for Volunteer America.
Right.
You led Volunteer America. You led it from a relatively small organisation through to a large trading organisation. Did you feel you were leading that, or did you feel you were cajoling members, or did you feel you were kind of rounding up sheep or cattle? What was it like leading an organisation like that?
Well, I suppose as any time you're with a group of people, there are times when if people look to you because of the role you're filling, and they look to you for decisions, they look for you for your advice, they're looking for somebody to help them reconcile different points of view, there are times when you feel like you really were providing that kind of leadership. There's other times when you feel like you're hanging on because something's been unleashed and it's moving and you can tell this, the momentum is there. And smart leaders will recognize when you just need to go where the direction is going and try to channel it a little bit and take advantage of perhaps a different perspective you have because you're getting additional information or different information. Make sure you're connecting the right people, connecting the right dots. And any large network, and the cooperative is really a movement. We don't tend to use that term these days in the world, but it really is a movement. It's people around the world with a similar idea who are applying that idea in their own culture. And so you're not going to have a monolithic control on something like that. Even if you tried to do it, it would squeeze out in a lot of different ways. And that was somewhat true where I've been before as well. Even though it was not a cooperative, it was the same sense that people had a mission. They had a passion for what they felt needed to be addressed.
Which in that case was volunteering.
Which was volunteering, and it grew beyond that into seeing some real problems that required business systems to address, capital infrastructure to address, to build housing, for example, as you know, David was talking about being such a fundamental human need, and we think a human right, dealing with healthcare issues. So it grew into having thousands of staff as well as tens of thousands of volunteers. So it grew into a large system, and people came to that for different reasons. And they had different needs, but they knew what the vision was, and they knew what the goal was. And as a leader, you have to be very responsible to the history of an organization, to the stewardship of it, as David has pointed out, and make certain that you're not substituting your great wisdom for the collective wisdom of the group. I think we're at a point in time where we know the value of crowdsourcing. We know we trust a group more than we trust individuals. In some, we trust them to be right. You know, it's
another the group delivering sort of the service or requiring the service.
That's right. I mean, we'll ask an audience rather than phone a friend. We'll get a better answer if you ask the audience. And one of our challenges, I think, in the cooperative sector is that somebody told me today. They said, you know, cooperation is growing faster than the cooperative sector. And I thought, you know, that's probably true. You look at Wikipedia and all these ideas. The idea of coming together and cooperating with people is a very powerful concept that's come into its own. And this generation, this next generation, has grown up with that, believes it passionately. We need to connect them now with the enterprise model that says, now, you know, you can make that a livelihood. You can create jobs with this. I talk to people here who say, we don't see the end of this tunnel. You know, this is a really deep recession. We don't see how we come out of this. Well, I see how you come out of it, and cooperation is core to coming out of it. You're gonna come out. You're gonna build something. You may as well build according to the cultural norms that people are now embracing, which is cooperation.
Talking about building, back to you then, David.
Yes.
when you are leading an organization,
yes,
and you're dealing with a lot of different members. You need a lot of capital, don't you, though? You need to convince people who go, okay, how are you guys set up? Well, you're not making the decision. Well, they make the decisions. Well, I'm putting millions of dollars in here.
Well,
how do they react, your investors?
No, yes, for any investor, you've got to recognize, and particularly institutional investors like pension funds that are custodians of people's future wealth, their current wealth and their future as well, it's very, very important. We understand due diligence for an investor, and you have to demonstrate, that you've got security over the asset, that the asset is good quality, that you have proper legal title to it, and that it is something that they can invest in. And they've got security for their large sums of capital that they're going to put into that. You then have to demonstrate to them that there is a long-term robust cash flow. That's actually much easier to do in a housing cooperative, where the residents are actively involved, where they individually may come and go, but the whole group, as Charles talked about, the crowd, the group of members who live there, have a long-term interest in the management and maintenance of that asset. And if think, if you were a pension fund investor, for example, and you saw that the asset that your money was going to fund is actually democratically controlled, in accordance with high standards, ethical standards of good governance, and that the people who live there are going to care for it, and we've got lots of evidence that shows that cooperatives care for housing better than any other type of housing owner, even homeowners. They're going to care for it, they're going to maintain it properly. It's going to be a vibrant, sustainable community that is concerned about the environment, concerned about social sustainability and economic sustainability. What better place to put your money?
Well, clearly I couldn't possibly comment, but that was David Rogers, the elected president of ICA Housing, talking to me with Charles Gould, the Director General of the International Cooperative Alliance, on what may well have been platform 9 3/4 at the old Central Station in Manchester.
The Guardian.
Sean Tarbuck is the Chief Executive of the International Cooperative and Mutual Insurance Federation. They represent 220 members in 70-plus countries around the world, and they're responsible for 26% of worldwide insurance business. I asked him how his members, the mutual and cooperative insurers, are leading the way in a somewhat topsy-turvy and financially rather dangerous world.
In 2007, the mutual and cooperative sector was 23.7% of the world's insurance market. 2011, we're 26.3%. That's nearly a 3% market share capture from, obviously, the stock companies. Why has that happened? It's happened because I think there's been a certain disenfranchisement of the general public. They're sick, sore and tired of large multinationals taking for granted the customers, and they're looking for an alternative. Now, what we've been doing as our members for the last 10 years has been promoting ourselves as value-based organisations, member-owned businesses, whatever you want to call us. We are different. We're customer-focused. The customer is the heart of everything that we do. And this message, I think, is starting to get out there. The movement, as you well know, in the cooperative movement and the mutual movement, both started here in this country, back in the 17th century and the 18th century. What we're seeing now is, I think, a movement in the last 10 years where organisations that are insurance and mutual have been promoting themselves actively and engaging with the members. So they've been listening, responding and engaging to the membership. And that really has resonance with the general public. Mm. And I think the general public are starting to see there is a difference. So although it's taken time, I think the message is starting to get out there. The social media message has been very important as well to get out there that there is a difference. So that difference is coming through in increased business, which is what we're seeing. And just in Europe alone, my members, which are only 220, so there's not that many of them, have employed 75,000 more people since 2007. So
that's a growth industry.
On top of, and that's only from 300,000. Mm. So that's a big increase in terms of employment. We're able to do that because our businesses are growing, because stat from 2007 to 2011, we have grown by 16% collectively, whereas the market's only grown by 4%. So again, we're outpacing the market considerably. Mm. If you're doing that and you're growing, you're going to employ more people. So we are the fastest growing part of the insurance sector because of our values. Now, our members are finding lots and lots of different ways of portraying that value. And it may be comparing themselves to stock companies by saying shareholder-driven companies only have shareholder values. Mm. Whereas we are driven by our members, we have stakeholder values. We are different, very different. It can be in terms of the pricing. Pricing traditionally for mutuals and co-ops have been a lot lower than the rest of the market. you can debate that, but now it's all in the open market. You can go to an aggregator website and choose and buy your insurance. Yep. It's all there. You can
we
see
can
it,
find
the bare
out.
Bones. Exactly. So it's out there in the open. Some are talking about their claims. So we have the best claims experience. We have happy customers. We have constantly, we're top of the customer satisfaction charts.
The thing about insurance companies is taking people's money, investing it, and making a return. How can cooperatives do that more efficiently or more effectively than a capitalist, money-driven, we want to make a load of money organisation?
Great question. There's, you've got to remember there's two sectors to insurance. One is life, which is what you're just referring to, and one is non-life. So if you've got most of the ones in this country particularly are what we call combined organisations, so they'll sell both. On the life side, what you tend to find is they are driven by their expense ratios, which are, in terms of the stock companies, are slightly higher than the mutuals. So we run a more low-cost efficient organisation. That's because the stock companies have to spend money on their investor relations side. So they've got to keep the city happy. And that's around about £2 in every 100 just to keep the city happy.
Just to keep friends with the people putting
exactly,
the money in.
Exactly. So we've got that £2 to give back to our customers,
right,
which they don't have to have. Now, on the non-life side, an average retention rate, which is how many customers stay with you year on year, because it's an annual decision for your motor and your home and any other types of insurance you may have that's annual, most of our members maintain their customers. So about 90% loyalty is probably the norm. In the stock companies, a 60% loyalty is the norm. There are a lot of rate hoppers, as we call them. And why do they rate hop? Because they can. And they have no loyalty to those particular customers. So here's the conundrum. A business model that loses 40% of its customers year on year, where does it get those 40% back just to stand still? It's called marketing and advertising. The spend that the stock companies spend on marketing and advertising is huge. And again, our expense ratios are 3 to 4% lower on average. That's £3 or £4 in every 100 lower. So therefore, we can actually give a better price, a better return, and we can actually not challenge everyone on our claims. How many of you have had a motor insurance claim recently or a home insurance claim? And the first question you get when you phone up the claims line is asking and querying as to, is this a right one? What's happened? You know, that they want to know how they can reduce their claim exposure. Whereas you phone a mutual, they say, are you okay? Are you happy?
Mm-hmm.
How can we help you? Mm. And they'll probably pay your claim in full.
That's the chief executive of the International Cooperative and Mutual Insurance Federation, Sean Tarbuck. Now to me, living in the 999 emergency town of Blackpool, the phrase bank transfer day means queuing in my dressing gown at a cash point at midnight. But apparently, in the US, it's a phrase that strikes fear into banks and great joy for credit unions. Kristen Christian is the founder of Bank Transfer Day and has effectively led a campaign that inspired millions of people in the US to change to a different, less corporate and with no shareholders type of banking. I asked her what motivated her to lead the way.
Well, I was definitely motivated by the principle behind Bank of America's policy to charge only the impoverished and working classes a $5 monthly fee for debit card access. To me, it seemed rather like a schoolyard bully, you know, picking on the kids with glasses. It just wasn't fair. It wasn't right. It wasn't just. And I decided that, you know, it is very true that the only thing necessary for evil to flourish is for good men to do nothing. And with that in mind, I decided to stand up and speak my piece about it.
So you can stand up and speak your piece. I mean, these days you might blog or you might tweet or you might sort of moan at Bank of America about it. But what did you practically decide to do then?
Well, I actually created a Facebook event, and I did that because it was easier to create a Facebook event and invite, you know, 500 people and have all of the information in one place rather than sending out 500 emails, getting 500 responses. What I like to tell people is really Facebook and all of social media is a language. And like any language, if you grow up speaking it, you're going to be naturally more fluent in it than someone who learns it at a later age. And you know, with that in mind, social media was actually just the perfect channel because the generation I felt, you know, really needed to hear this message is the millennial generation.
Now, in terms of, I mean, it's a good job you didn't do it via email, because how many emails would you be sending out now?
Well, goodness, I can tell you, even just doing it on a Facebook event, my email inbox fills up every day. And
wow.
Every day I have to go back through and, you know, respond to the emails. So I can tell you honestly, if I would have chosen to do it in a more archaic way, I would be absolutely overwhelmed, as is I'm so incredibly busy. But somehow, you know, using social media is such a natural tool that enables me to be essentially a one-woman army, if you will, and, you know, not only advocate for consumer empowerment and now voter empowerment through Bank Transfer Day, but then also consult and speak and work with cooperatives and other sustainable organizations to help them understand how they can share their mission with this next incoming generation of consumers, small business owners, and government leaders.
Well, actually, you know, you've mentioned leaders there. If you look at the past, the old way of doing things, leadership did come from those that were elected, or perhaps those that were celebrities or those that were famous. What you've managed to do is, in a way, no disrespect, sort of come from nowhere, and using these tools, you're in a position to actually, you know, lead change.
You know, I would say, to that effect, though, something my father always told me, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And I think with this idea, our societies were ready. And I think that's why someone who was, you know, relatively anonymous, though not a member of Anonymous, was able to come bust onto the scene and share this idea in a very authentic way and have the message be received so far and wide.
So let's just quantify what you've managed to achieve here. It started from a sort of Facebook post. You thought, you know what, that really annoys me about what they're doing to poor people that need banking. What effect have you had? What have you changed?
Well, to date, there are two major changes that I am just so, well, actually three, that I'm so completely humbled by. One, in my own country, to date, 6 million Americans have changed the way they bank. That
Amazing.
Is 500,000 Americans every single month. The numbers have not stopped. They have not decreased. We're still seeing these numbers prevalent every single day. Two, to see the movement spread abroad into so many other countries and adapted into individual economies and see other people taking it upon themselves to have this huge, huge impact. And finally, three, it actually was brought to my attention recently that political science professors at some of the top universities are now teaching the model of Bank Transfer Day as a concept to future politicians and campaign advisors. And they're teaching this to them because they want these young men and women to understand that for the future of politics, you will not need a significant amount of campaign funding to have a significant impact.
That's Kristen Christian, the founder of Bank Transfer Day. And find out more on Facebook or go to socialenterprise.guardian.co.uk. And while you're there, join the Guardian Social Enterprise Network, because this month there'll be reports from the Shine Un Conference as they offer some important help for social ventures who are hoping to grow in the coming year. Plus, the Guardian's professional network will be reporting from the Social Value Conference, which is an event that will debunk and explain how social enterprise can bid for public sector contracts and how the public sector needs to respond to the changes brought about by the Social Value Act. So here's how you get in touch. You can email me at seanmcginty.co.uk or david.mills@guardian.co.uk. Please go to socialenterprise.guardian.co.uk and make your thoughts known on this podcast and look at all the fabulous news and interviews there. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet your thoughts to @GuardianSockEnt, or for my personal Twitter, it's @SeanAMcGinty. Please remember to share us with your friends and colleagues in the usual way. Next month, we're talking about scaling up in social enterprises. So any ideas, please send them my way. I'm Sean McGinty. Thanks for listening and see you next time for more news, comments and information from the Guardian Social Enterprise Network. You should join it. It's free.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.